This is the TriDot Podcast. TriDot uses your training data and genetic profile combined with predictive analytics and artificial intelligence to optimize your training, giving you better results in less time with fewer injuries. Our podcast is here to educate, inspire, and entertain. We'll talk all things triathlon with expert coaches and special guests. Join the conversation and let's improve together.
Welcome to the TriDot Podcast. We've got a great topic today. There are all sorts of locations that offer performance testing for triathletes. And I'll be asking two TriDot coaches if performance testing is worth our time and money. And we've got a new coach on the show for this one. New to the show, definitely not new to triathlon coaching. It's TriDot coach Chris Navin from Chicago, Illinois. Chris has raced over 100 triathlons and 250 endurance races. He is a Kona finisher, a more than 38-time marathoner. He's got over 20 Ironman finishes to his credit, ranking as high as 9th in the U.S. and 33rd in the world in his Ironman age group rankings. Chris is a Level 2 USA Triathlon Certified Coach and head endurance coach of 4-Star Endurance and a team to end AIDS. Chris, welcome to the show.
Hey, gang. It's an honor to finally be on the show.
Also with us is Coach Jeff Rains. Jeff is a USA Triathlon Level 2 Ironman U certified coach and TriDot master coach who has a Master of Science in Exercise Physiology and was a D1 collegiate runner. He has over 60 Ironman event finishes to his credit and has coached hundreds of athletes to the Ironman finish line. Jeff has been training and coaching with TriDot since 2015. Hey there, Jeff.
What's up, Andrew? How's daddy life?
It's going. I'm Andrew, the average triathlete, voice of the people, and captain of the middle of the pack. As always, we'll roll through our warm-up question, settle in for our main set topic, and then wind things down with Vanessa taking over for the cooldown. Lots of good stuff. Let's get to it.
Time to warm up. Let's get moving.
There is literally an endless supply of podcasts out there in the wild. As the medium continues to grow, the joke amongst podcasters is who doesn't have a podcast these days? Personally, I love it. Go ahead, start a podcast. Podcasting is fun. But anyway, our warm-up question for today. Chris, Jeff, what is your favorite non-endurance sports-related podcast to listen to? Coach Chris.
That's a tough one because most of the podcasts I listen to are endurance sports related. there's actually a ton of one of my hobbies living here in Chicago is architecture. So I listen to different vlogs and blogs about architecture, and I live right downtown. So
okay.
That's a big hobby of mine. And I like the B1M vlog. That's one of my favorites.
Okay. Yeah. No. Good. See, we're already getting a peek into your personal life just by the asking you a warm-up question. So, good to know that about you. That makes sense. When I was scouting out your website, kind of researching you for this episode, you got a lot of Chicago imagery built into your website, and obviously proud of your roots there. So, we TriDot has a great presence in Chicago, and actually, there is a Chicago Facebook group for TriDot specifically. Isn't that right, Chris?
Yeah. Yep. I am TriDot Chicago.
Yeah, so if you're from the Chicago area and you're listening to this, make sure you're part of the Chicago area, Chicago Metroplex, I Am TriDot Facebook group. Coach Jeff Rains, what is a non-endurance sports-related podcast that you enjoy listening to?
You know, I really enjoy The Bible Project. They do a great job of providing great content, breaking down the Bible and making it fun. And they also have some video aspects to it as well through YouTube, and it's just they do a great job. I love it; it's very entertaining, and that's probably the most listened to one outside of training, running type podcasts.
Yeah, so I've seen a lot of their material on YouTube and on social media. I was unaware that they had a podcast, so that's very, very cool to know. Let's check that out. Jeff, as a family man with the kids, is that a resource you use kind of with your kiddos to kind of share some of the stories with them?
Yeah, they do a great job of just breaking it down for adults to really understand some of the deep stuff, and so that in turn, yeah, absolutely makes it all the better and easier as a parent to relay that down to the kind of kiddo elementary level, let's say. So absolutely.
Well, I will give a shout out that there's several I listen to just depending on the time of year. And ironically, ever since starting a podcast, I probably listen to less podcasts now than I did before having my own podcast. And by the time you script a podcast, record a podcast, publish podcasts, you lose some of your personal podcast listening time. So, but I still have a few that I make sure I get to throughout my month, throughout the week, depending on the year. My all-time favorite one, I have kind of my personal way to stay in touch with my best friends from college is we have a fantasy football league. Every time the NFL kicks back up, that's the only league I do now. I've kind of moved on from the whole fantasy sports thing, except for this one league, because it's my way to stay in touch with my college friends. And so just to make sure I'm competitive and I know what I'm talking about and that I'm consistently doing a good job in that league, not finishing last place, I have a podcast to listen to called The Fantasy Footballers. They're just three guys that they're very entertaining and they just kind of share their thoughts and their insights into kind of prepping your fantasy team for every single week, talking through which players might play really well this week based on matchups and this and that and all that fantasy nerdom. But they're great guys.
You're just getting cheats to the
honestly. Yeah. Honestly, instead of doing a ton of research myself, I just listen to them. They know what they're talking about. And then I kind of learn what I can learn and set my lineup and then go dominate on Sunday. We're curious to hear from you, our listener. What is your favorite non-endurance sports-related podcast? Now, I pitch it that way because obviously the Try That Podcast is your favorite endurance sports-related podcast, and if it's not, just lie to me and tell me that it is. But I'm going to throw a post out to the Ion Try That Facebook group asking you, from all the podcasts out there, not endurance sports-related, what is one that you just love firing up whenever they drop a new episode? Let us know in the comments on the Ion Try That Facebook group. Can't wait to see what you have to say.
On to the main set. Going in 3, 2, 1.
We are thrilled to have Sailfish as the swim partner of TriDot Training. Sailfish was founded in 2007 by Jan Sibbersen, who was on the national German team and is the fastest swimmer to ever hit the waters of Ironman. The Sailfish mission is to create premium triathlon and open water swim products, and with the Kona course record holder personally testing everything they make, you know you are getting something special when you order from Sailfish. Sailfish certainly offers swim skins, tri suits, and swim accessories, but the core of the Sailfish product line are their award-winning wetsuits, known for their outstanding flexibility, balanced buoyancy, and distinguished gliding properties in the water. Sailfish wetsuits are truly made to make you faster. And that certainly has been the case for me. I have swam in many different brands of wetsuits over the years, and my Sailfish is the very first one that I put on, got in the water, and clocked swim splits I had no business hitting on my own. For me, it was love at first stroke. With several models and price points, there for sure will be a Sailfish wetsuit that is right for you. So head to sailfish.com to check out all the neoprene goodness and use code Sailfish SFC20 at checkout for 20% off your new wetsuit. There are a number of lab-style performance tests that can give a triathlete insight into different aspects of their body or their performance. Things like VO2 max testing, blood lactate testing, VO2 calorie expenditure testing, and more. What is helpful? Who should be doing these? Where should you be getting these things done? And what do we do with the results once we get these tests? All that and more with Coach Chris and Coach Jeff. Now, Chris, it's your very first time on the show, so before I ask you about the science of performance testing, I want to ask you about you, the triathlete and the coach, from Kona to representing Team USA to Zwift Racing. I mean, you have loads of tri experience. So from all of that, from all your time on course, what is maybe your favorite memory or your favorite triathlon story to tell?
Yeah, that's a tough one because I have a lot of races I've done. You know, Kona is definitely up there. I call that one of my top five, you know, favorite experiences ever.
Sure. It's got to be.
Alcatraz is also one of my favorite ones.
Yeah, got to be.
And Ironman New York City when they had a one-time-only event in this New York where you swam at the Hudson. But yeah, sometimes I like to just share my first triathlon experience because I'm not a top athlete. You know, I started as a back of the packer. I did my first triathlon in a mountain bike and could barely swim. So I was aqua jogging and backstroking the swim just to get through. But since getting into metabolic testing and whatnot, obviously I've focused more on the performance side. So one of my more recent favorite memories I like to share sometimes is, simply because I use some metabolic testing data for it, is I tried to create my own challenge. At the Chicago Triathlon, they have what's called the Triple Challenge, where you do all three events in one weekend. And I came up with my own quintuple challenge, where by pacing every race perfectly, I figured out a way to do the super sprint race on Saturday fast enough to line back up and get to join the last wave, which is on a Divvy bike share. You get your bike provided by the local city bike share, so you don't have to bring a second bike. So I would squeeze out two super sprints quickly enough within the scope, the time span of the one race. And then on Sunday, where they have the big race, where they have a sprint distance and Olympic distance, I did the Olympic fast enough, and I had an entry with our charity team to do the sprint right afterwards and still try to make it in time to do the very last wave of the day and do five races in the span of what they typically only allow three for. But the year I was attempting it, they canceled the swim and turned it into a duathlon, and I missed the final wave by just a minute or two. But it's always fun to just, you know, take triathlon, try to do something fun with it, and enjoy the experience.
Yeah, so you're really going for five races, and you got four of the five.
Yeah,
no fault of your own.
I completed the quadruple, which one other person I think I know of, at least one, has done four of the Chicago Tri races in one weekend. But the quintuple, doing five, is still a challenge that I have
out there.
Yeah, it's still out there. So I might at some point attempt it again if I can get my fitness to that point and get the logistics down to do it.
Yeah, please let us follow along if you do that. Please let us capture that journey, perhaps for our YouTube show or something. Chris, very much like Coach Jeff Raines, who is also on this podcast. I mean, you've done studying. You've got your specialties. You know, you're a certified coach in swim, bike, and run individually. You know, you've done spin classes. You're a tryout pool school coach. And most importantly, for the conversation today, you specialize in metabolic testing. For that one specifically, what does a coach or a sports scientist perhaps have to do to become a metabolic performance testing specialist?
Yeah, it's a tough one. There's not a typical way, I would say, that necessarily, you know, the main way that a lot of people get into metabolic testing is typically if you're going through an exercise physiology program, exercise science, you have people that come from a university setting who get into testing, but they oftentimes have the science background, the education background, but not necessarily the experience or the application perspective that a lot of endurance athletes are kind of looking for. So I would say if someone was a sports scientist, they should really focus on using the data, applying it with athletes. So learning to coach and also doing more events or doing more endurance events themselves. Coaches, on the other hand, if they want to get into becoming a metabolic specialist, I really think they need to focus on what they might not have gotten if they don't have that exercise science background, and just learning, you know, learn, educate your brain, train your brain, try to absorb as much information as you can, you know, reach out to experts in the industry. Because a lot of it actually, for me, even when I started getting into it, like I really liked the science aspect of it. I had a lot of experience, but it took actually a lot of just doing it, doing testing, both on myself and on, you know, other coaches, other athletes. Because there's definitely something to be said by, you know, the art and science of doing testing and doing and a lot of that.
Almost like getting a bike fit.
Yeah.
There's numbers and geometries and angles, but then there's the art of getting that athlete in the right position for whatever race they're doing.
And bike fit is kind of the perfect parallel, yep.
Yeah, I think a lot, a lot of exercise testing kind of starts out, like you said, in that research setting, that lab setting. They're using the modalities of, you know, performance testing to provide data for the research that they're, partaking in. And, I think a lot of exercise physiologists in general start off in that realm. And then those who understand the sport, let's say of triathlon or the performance side, kind of veer out of that maybe potential research setting into more of a practical or athlete type setting for sure.
Yeah. And I, one example I use too, just from my own background is, you know, when I had done a lot of testing, I ended up getting a lot of athletes in from the ultra distance racing world, like trail running and, you know, ultra distance marathons, but I had never done them. You know, I knew from the numbers what should work for a fueling plan, what should work for a pacing plan. And I had done Ironmans, but I had never done an ultra marathon other than a 50K. And so we had one of our coaches, who's also a PhD down in South Africa, he got us interested in doing the Two Oceans Ultra Marathon, which is like a 35-mile race. And I hadn't actually trained for it. I knew my numbers, and I said, okay, this will be an experiment. I'm going to see if I can take what I learned in the lab and apply it and see if it actually works. And I paced that race without walking a single step, you know, start to finish, kept the heart rate right where I needed to. And, you know, I learned quite a bit from that type of experience. So even though I had done a lot of testing and I had a lot of race experience, I'd never done this other type of race. So I think it's always important, whether you're a coach or a sports scientist or someone who's just interested in getting into it, take the data and then apply it, you know, put yourself in there in a field test environment to build that experience. I think that's the key.
All right. Well, that's enough about Chris. I want to get into the science here today. Now, I've already thrown the words performance testing and metabolic testing around quite a bit. I'm not a scientist in this area, so I'm probably using those interchangeably, and I probably should not, but that's all right. Chris and Jeff can correct me on that. So Chris, Jeff, what is this? What is metabolic testing? What tests are out there for triathletes to actually potentially do?
Metabolic testing involves evaluating a person's metabolic rate at which they burn calories as energy and use oxygen. And so there's just many ways you can break that down. RMR is probably one that many use as far as it's resting metabolic rate, but it's how much work your body does at rest. VO2 max is a big one, right? The max volume of oxygen and anaerobic capacity. BMP, basic metabolic panel, that's blood work. You can get blood work to kind of see at a baseline what's going on currently. One that I did a lot of extensive work back in graduate and post years, body composition, a lot of different numbers, let's say metrics that you can gain from those. And, you know, there's very basic things to track body composition for triathletes in particular, rather than just standing on the scale. The weight can stay the same all year, but your body will look a little bit different at different types of the season.
Very interesting. Yeah, very interesting.
There's bod pod, air displacement. You can sit in this little pod. There's all sorts of things. There's underwater weighing, hydrostatic weighing. The DEXA scan is cool because I knew which areas of my body had greater and or less bone mass. I remember the guy in the lab on one of mine said, "Jeff, don't be a boxer." I'm like, why? You know, I'm not tough enough. Come on, man. And he's like, no, like your ribs of all of your body are on the lower end of normal bone density, your ribs. So like, be careful. Don't go be a linebacker or something like that. Just little things like that are kind of cool to know.
It's a good thing you're a runner. It's a good thing you're just an endurance athlete who doesn't take shots to the ribs on purpose anyway. Maybe from your kids. I don't know. But yeah. And Dr. Krista Austin coming on and talking nutrition with us sometimes has definitely referred to some of these tests. So some of those are getting into body composition and nutrition. And so today we're really focused on the performance testing that has more to do with your metabolism and the metabolic testing. Cause these are the kind of things that if you're a triathlete, you might see your local bike fitter will offer metabolic testing. You might notice that your local triathlon shop or your running store might offer this, your local coach, like, Chris might offer this kind of testing. And I just want people to know, when you see metabolic testing, when you see blood lactate, VO2, all these kind of things, like, what does this mean? And so those are the ones we're going to really focus on today. But Jeff, thanks for that that great list there. Because, yeah, there's tons of tests out there that people have probably heard of. Jeff, I'm curious just for you. I mean, Chris has kind of talked a little bit here in the intro, but from these tests, you know, that you kind of just referenced, you know, what have you personally had done? And I guess probably even more interesting, as a coach, what testing do you like to see your coached athletes consider and pay for?
Yeah, I mean, good question. Really, I use a lot of these modalities to track gains and losses throughout the season or season to season. And so I kind of use them more as benchmarks. It's all adaptable. It's all always constantly changing as well. And so your VO2 max, you know, from a year ago is not the same as it is now. It's not even 10 weeks ago that, you know, you know, what I used to do really, you know, back in grad school is I did a lot of VO2 testing. We could do this swimming in an endless pool. So how your thresholds and consumption and expenditure is a little bit different being, you know, laying down or swimming in the water versus sitting on a bike versus on a treadmill. And we would just do a lot of cool things like that. Now, obviously VO2 testing in elite athletes is a big deal. Trying to see that peak performance. We would also do, like the Texas Rangers, they would come into our lab and they were required to, get all sorts of this testing done, but we would track, because if you think about it, they have a very long season. Same with NFL. We did this in the police academy as well. But they would come in and get testing, 2 to 3 times a year. They have to be on point. Like we might do B and C races to work our way into peak shape for that one big A race or that one big performance at the end of the year. But think of like certain athletes, like Major League Baseball players, where they have to be in
NFL.
Where
they play 4,000 games a year.
Yeah, and they have to be 100%, day one, game one, 100%. Yeah. And they have to maintain that max or that peak, let's say, all year long. And so we would do testing pre, mid, and postseason. And body composition as well as performance metabolic testing to see just how these things, the resting metabolic rates and all these things change. But RMR is probably the biggest one. A lot of athletes, you know, want to know how much they you know, could afford to lose weight or what is my optimal race weight or I want to lose 10 pounds and how do I train vigorously and still be healthy enough. And so resting metabolic rate is something that's really good to know. And then you can compare, well, how many calories do you burn on top of that through your exercise? And then if you are wanting to lose weight, you know, we don't want to lose more than, you know, a deficit of more than a couple hundred calories per day. And we want to do that safely and slowly and over time and things like that. So that's probably the one of the bigger ones that I focus on with my athletes.
Yeah. All right. From everything you just said, I just have to throw this in there. A little tried out partner trivia. One of our partners, Precision Fuel and Hydration, they do the sweat testing for the Texas Ranger baseball team. That is one of the teams that they test a number of the pro sports teams, and that is one that they test every single year. Anyway, moving on. So I want to get into, Jeff, you just identified for us a ton of different tests. And like I said, we're going to really focus on the metabolic testing here today. Chris is our expert. He's our spirit guide, so to speak, on these, because he does these with athletes every single day. So I want to hear from him on the science behind it. I want to hear from Jeff on applying this to our athletes. So we're going to run through just that list of specifically the metabolic tests. And I just want to hear what each of these is testing for, you know, how they are conducted and what athletes can learn from each of these tests. So first up, VO2 max testing. Chris, what is this?
Yeah, so VO2 max testing is what we call the active metabolic rate. So Jeff did a great job explaining, you know, especially the resting metabolism someone might have, which is testing you when you're lying down. The active metabolic rate test is simply looking at the same exact thing, but while you're working out. So oftentimes I compare that to thinking about your 24 hours of the day. You know, there's a certain number of hours of the day that your resting metabolism is burning calories, but there's probably at least an hour or so per day where you're actively burning more calories.
Hopefully.
And figuring out how many calories you're burning is very helpful. And so typically VO2 max testing is done for a couple different reasons. One is to assess your VO2 max, which is a number that measures the volume of oxygen that you're consuming and that your body is using, how efficiently your body is working. It also takes into account your body mass. So it's a great single number that can tell you, do you have good body composition and is your metabolism working well? And so you get a fitness score. You also get your heart rate zones figured out. So you can figure out where does your body go anaerobic? Where do you burn more fat? Where do you burn more carbs? And that really gives you the structure to know, okay, am I training in my zones properly to confirm? Luckily with Tri-Dot automatically determines your heart rate zones off of your assessments. And then metabolic testing can look at it in more detail. So it's a good learning experience, I always like to say.
Yeah.
But it's a ramp test. So you basically get on a treadmill, ideally. You can do it on a bike, you can do it on rowing machines, all different types of devices. And you just look at how your body's metabolism changes as your heart rate goes up. And you don't have to do a max effort at the end. You know, they call it VO2 max testing, but sometimes they call it VO2 sub-maximal testing. So you're just gradually bringing the heart rate up. And sometimes people have learned about a similar protocol in hospital settings when they scan your heart. So my wife is a cardiac sonographer. She scans people in the hospital and they do a ramp test, which is oftentimes done through the Bruce protocol. And then I test people in more of a performance setting, but we actually use almost the identical testing protocol. It's just a gradual ramp test. At the hospital, they stop you earlier. They predetermine when to stop you. In a fitness setting, generally speaking, as long as you're in good health and everything, we let you go to a max effort, which for most people will end up not being at your max heart rate, but usually like 90 to 95% of your max heart rate is where we'll end the test when we figure out your true VO2 max. So that gives you the metabolism for the 1 hour of the day you're working out. And then if you combine that with that resting metabolic rate test, then you really have a 24-hour picture of your whole metabolism.
Now, Chris, you mentioned it can be done on the treadmill, on the bike, on a rowing machine. Are the results different from run to bike, or is it just the way our body processes just regardless of the activity itself, or is it activity dependent?
Yeah, it's definitely activity dependent. Generally, we try to have people always do it in the most aerobic way possible, which is generally running, because you're using your whole body, you're fighting gravity, you're not applying a lot of resistance onto something. So it's a more aerobic way to do it, as a treadmill test is the most popular. And it can be done with either increasing speed or incline or both. So you don't actually have to run. It could be done as a walking test with just a steep incline. But you can test it cycling as well. The problem with cycling is your upper body is mostly stationary. We do rowing as well, where you're using your whole body. But it's still because of the resistance. Sometimes people will fatigue because of muscular fatigue rather than aerobic fatigue.
Now, we love our friends at Garmin. Garmin watches and Garmin devices are world-class for tracking swim, bike, and running. But we have to poke fun a little bit about some of the resting recommendations, the sleep recommendations, the things that our Garmin claims to know about us. And one of those things is my Garmin ever so often will beep and say that my VO2 max has been updated and it's changed. It's gone up. It's gotten better. It's gotten worse, whatever. Is that, Chris, is that an accurate number whatsoever? Or is that a ballpark and it's best to probably get this tested, or is that actually somewhat fairly accurate?
Generally, I've tested a lot of people where we've compared it to their Garmins or their smart devices, and and usually Garmin is within about 5%. So usually Garmin's pretty spot on, just as a fitness scoring method. But you have to keep in mind two important things. One, you want to be wearing your Garmin watch all the time, and two, you need to have you need to have enough data for the watch to learn about you. If you just slap it on after a week, it probably does not have enough data on you. And the way Garmin determines the VO2 max score, depending on bike, run, like for running, they do your best 12-minute run, I believe it is, or 8 or 12 minute run. So if you've never done like an all-out 8 or 12 minute effort, like a 5K, like the 5K assessment we do at TriDot, it never really will know what your true VO2 max score is. It will just guesstimate it off of your best run effort. So you need to have enough data and you need to have done some hard enough efforts for it to actually be relatively accurate.
See, I'm that kind that I don't like to wear that watch all day, every day.
Yeah, that's the problem for a lot of people.
I only wear my watch. And so like I'll see it and I'm like, oh, cool, I increased. And I'm like, psh, that's... come on, man. Like, you're shortchanging me. I'm like, no, that's bogus. And then I'll actually say, like, you know, like when we were in the lab and we would try to collect data, and an elite athlete would come in, and, you know, a group of them would come in and we would test them, and they would, you know, compete with each other. You know, there's a motivation aspect. Like, I want to get a higher VO2 max than you. Oh, he got 81. I want 82, you know, things like that. But we would say, like, if you're a cyclist, then let's use, you know, the bike. If you're a runner, now I know that running and clinical settings, I think the bike is probably a little bit more popular, just because, let's say, like the elderly and coming back from rehab, things like that. They'll do some testing.
My Garmin watch right now, like on the default home screen, I look down and my Garmin watch says VO2 max 51. Now I have not worn my watch around the clock, in years. I haven't done a hard run effort in years. So I know that number is not accurate, but that's very interesting, Chris, to hear that, that if you are doing those things, that, yeah, it's actually pretty good. And if not, you should probably go to the lab and get that tested.
It's fun to see the number, but yeah, at the end of the day, you know, the VO2 max number is not something on a daily basis that you're using necessarily to guide your training. It's a fun way to assess your fitness. And usually that's actually why we recommend coming to a lab and getting tested, because you will, you'll get coached to put in your best effort possible to get the score as accurate as possible. But it's also helpful, you know, as you get older too, and you think, oh, I feel like my fitness is declining. You know, sometimes testing and seeing that you actually still have a really high VO2 number is a great way to stay motivated. And that's why I have all of my athletes pretty much as much as I can test every year. Every year you get older, you're in a new age group maybe, can you beat your younger self? And nine times out of 10, the VO2 number, someone's true VO2 max number, is really correlated more to your activity level, not your age and how you perform. It's simply how active you are. And if you stay active as you get older, you will see that VO2 max number go up.
And just for the record, when you see or hear those numbers, like for example, like average VO2s for people in their 30s to let's say mid 40s, women it's about 31 and men it's 42. But what that means, let's say for that female, 31 milliliters of oxygen diffused and utilized per kilogram of body weight. So you inhale oxygen, you breathe out CO2, but what that number is, it's how much oxygen is actually being diffused and into the system and utilized, you know, by the body. So the fitter that you are, the more that you can diffuse and the more that you can utilize. And so a higher milliliter volume of oxygen per kilogram of your body weight is what is being utilized. And that's the number that's being spit out. So that's that number that's being guesstimated by that Garmin watch and thrown out to you.
Jeff, you're a real Bill Nye the Science Guy over there with that. Thanks for that. That was a great explanation. Moving on to the next one, and Jeff, this is one that you also kind of already talked about a little bit, but Chris, I'm curious to hear you maybe dive a little bit deeper. Resting metabolic rate, RMR, what is this?
The RMR, the resting metabolic rate, is just like the VO2. The VO2 is the AMR, the active metabolic rate, and then the resting test is called the RMR. So it's looking at what your body's metabolism is doing for the 36 hours of the, or 36, 23 hours of the day you're not working out typically. And we use that test a lot to evaluate someone's diet and nutrition, especially. So if you're trying to, you know, figure out, okay, why am I not gaining or losing weight the way I want to? How many calories a day should I be eating? Is there something going on? Sometimes, you know, stress, hormones, you know, lack of sleep, things can affect your metabolism. And so typically where on the active test, we test your performance, and typically a coach or someone will guide you on how you use this information for training. The RMR test will be bundled with a consultation. Generally, we always do them with either like a nutritionist or a registered dietitian, ideally. An RD has a lot more experience in diagnosing conditions. So an RD ideally would then take that information and give you a consultation about, okay, now let's look at your diet. Should we change your macros, you know, protein, fats, carbs? How can we use this information then to guide you? I like to use it a lot because sometimes when an athlete, you know, might tell me, oh yeah, they're fueling properly, they're eating good meals. When they do an RMR test, we see not just the calories per day, we also see where the body is oxidizing enough fat or carbs. So we can tell if at rest, is your body actually oxidizing fat or not? And in some cases, if someone's diet is bad or they drink too much alcohol, they go out and party too much, we'll see that their fat metabolism is a little bit suppressed. And we can actually see that actually both in the AMR and the RMR to some degree. And that will really help us guide and coach the athlete on understanding diet and fueling as a whole. And so I always like to do both tests together. And like in my business, we call that the metabolic 360. It gives you the 360 degree view of your metabolism by doing both tests in one appointment. And so we cover your nutrition, you know, all of your resting metabolic needs and your active metabolic needs. So it's a lot of times you'll see those same facilities offer both types of testing, but each one technically should have a consultation with an expert that might even be in a slightly different field, either a nutrition, a registered dietitian expert, and or on the active side, someone who's a coach or an exercise physiologist, or, you know, if someone's looking out there to find a place to get tested, try to do it in the sport that you're doing. You know, like I have a lot of rowers that come to me. I have a lot of marathon runners that come to me and a lot of triathletes that come to me, but I'm not an expert in non-endurance sports. So there might be other sports where you want to get tested by people in those specific fields, because in the consultation and the review of the data, that's what you're actually paying for. You know, anyone can do the test and give you your number, but it's really about how you use that information in a practical way. And so always check to make sure you're, you know, getting some type of consultation, and it's not just they'll email you a report a couple of days later.
Yep. No, that's great, Chris. Really great insight. I'm curious, for an RMR test, what does the result look like? Is it a number that is reflective of a bunch of stuff, or is there a more in-depth kind of profile there?
Yeah, you get your RMR, your resting metabolic rate, which is just how many calories per day your body is consuming.
Test number three that we're talking into. I've got four metabolic tests on my sheet in front of me. We're halfway through them. So number three is blood lactate testing. Chris, what is this?
So blood lactate testing we use actually in concert oftentimes with VO2 testing. So blood lactate testing can be used for a number of different reasons, but generally you're trying to find out similar information during a VO2 or an active metabolic rate test. You're trying to figure out how to set up your heart rate zones, but you're looking at what we call a direct measurement. When you're doing a VO2 test, you're looking at an indirect measurement. You're looking at your breath coming out of your body. It's kind of like if you have I use the analogy of a campfire. If you look at a campfire and you see the smoke coming out of the fire, you can actually tell what was burning in that fire. That's what we're doing when we're doing the oxygen exchange testing. When we do the lactate testing, it's actually like sticking a probe into the fire to measure what's going on in there. So you get a more direct measurement, and that's why it is, in a lot of ways, or at least it used to be considered the gold standard of testing, because we actually look at the lactate concentration in your blood. And if that gets to a certain level, we know your performance will begin to decline. And so if we prick you enough and take enough blood samples as your heart rate goes up, we can figure out at what point does your body's performance begin to decline. And usually there's like a clearly defined inflection point, which will tell us where your anaerobic threshold is. And so that information helps us figure out heart rate zones. But we can get the same information from just a regular VO2 test. So if you don't want to get pricked, you know, to take little blood samples every so often, the VO2 test is less invasive. You just wear a mask and you breathe in. But the lactate test, we actually take either a finger or usually an ear prick, and we're taking samples every couple minutes. The protocols sometimes are different. Usually we'll have people do like a set duration effort and measure lactate at the end of that duration, take a break, look at how much the lactate goes back down, then do another one. Sometimes we do it as just a straight ramp test. There's different protocols for different sports. But the end goal of a basic blood lactate test is to figure out your heart rate zones, figure out how to dial in your training. You can also use it in some pretty creative ways too, where just based on how quickly the lactate builds up, we can figure out, okay, if we were to optimize an interval workout for you, where should your FTP be set, and then how much recovery time should we give you between the intervals? So oftentimes you use blood lactate testing to actually guide, especially in elite cycling, we see this, to guide elite cyclists on, okay, what's their next training block going to look like? You know, and they'll test every month or every 2 months, and they'll do it all throughout the year. You also have field testing. You know, sometimes out on the track, we'll have people just do track repeats and be able to do a metabolic test out in the field, outdoors. Whereas usually with the VO2 testing, there are some mobile units that we use, but generally it's in a lab in a controlled setting. And in the ideal world as a coach, I always want to get a good baseline on my athletes from a lab test, but I also like to see at least one or two good field tests, you know, one in hot conditions, one in cool conditions. And so lactate testing can sometimes be used to complement the metabolic test as well. But there's a lot of ways. You see the Norwegians use it in their YouTube videos, and a lot of elite triathletes will use it just, and they, I think the Norwegians use it mostly with altitude, like they're training at different altitudes. And so they want to see how quickly they respond to the altitude, and they want to see how they need to adjust their zones when they go to altitude. So oftentimes lactate testing is used quite a bit just for for altitude testing. But I have a number of athletes who've seen all those YouTube videos, and now they want to get their own lactate meter. They want to test themselves. And there's a lot of nuance. There's a little bit of art and science to making sure you get good data from the lactate tests. And it's also expensive. People don't realize, you know, each finger prick, you have to have a thing to prick your finger with. You have to have wipes and cleaning supplies. You have to have the test strips. And, you know, every finger prick is a couple dollars. So it adds up.
And the analyzer
quick.
And the biohazard bag. Yep. There's blood involved. There's a lot of rules. I'd love to add something. Just you talk about like getting the data in the lab and then field testing it is crucial. And we would do both. We would test elite athletes in the lab, VO2, all the data, and we would take them immediately to the track and do an absolute all-out 400-meter dash. We would prick them before, immediately across the finish line, and 10 minutes into recovery. And what you could see, and what you, I used it more for recovery rate. 10 minutes after that, you know, 52-second 400 to some of these guys ran, 3 minutes, 6 minutes, they're done. They're back to normal. They could do another interval. Some 10 minutes in, they were still climbing. And wow. And my thesis involved exercise performance compared sleep deprivation to interrupted sleep. Total sleep deprivation, obviously, you know, it's like you stay up all night, your metabolic functioning's out of whack. But repeated bouts, so waking up, so like the night before an event, if you just toss and turn before that Ironman and you're just like, I can't sleep. Should I just get up, pull the all-nighter? Or should I just stay in bed and try to fight it? But anyways, long story short there is that I presented it to my collegiate track coach. And I was like, look, like we would just race each other on a Tuesday. Like, okay, 10 400s with 60 seconds rest. Oh, Reigns on the ninth one, he died. These other couple guys kept pushing strong. I'm taking these other guys to the meet, right? So to speak, hypothetical. I made all the meets. Thank you very much. But anyways, I always thought that was a little unfair, right? Because some people could do repeated bouts and just crush it. Some people have just one end-all, be-all, super hardcore, honest effort, and they're amazing at it. And so I just thought it was neat how different people respond differently into the recovery category. And
the one thing I know a lot of people oftentimes get is the question of, you know, should I do a blood lactate test or should I do a VO2 test to figure out heart rate zones and things like that? That's a very common and very valid question we get quite a bit. That's why we even do both together sometimes. But generally speaking, one thing for people to realize with metabolic testing is if we want to understand fat and carb metabolism, that's where you might want to focus more on the active metabolic rate testing. And the lactate is just that extra test to give you that 1 or 2% more, or to simply confirm that direct measurement. A big difference between the testing is the lactate testing, you're only taking one data point every couple minutes, generally speaking.
At a very specific intensity.
Yeah. And with the VO2 testing, we're getting data every second, recording data at least every 15 seconds. And so for figuring out heart rate zones and inflection points, you know, and different coaches might debate this, but the newer metabolic cars seem to, you know, give more data. And when you have more data, you can dial things in typically a little bit quicker. But that's why, generally speaking, I'll always have people do that VO2 test first. You know, the active and resting metabolism is a great starting point for anybody, regardless of fitness, age, gender. And then the lactate testing is when you want to start getting that 1 or 2% more. You want to get a little more precision with everything and reconfirm field test data, especially different environments. Just like the Tried Out platform, you know, we want to have assessments done pretty often, and you can do them indoors, outdoors. You know, the more variety you get, the more data you can confirm and reconfirm how your metabolism really functions. So it's exciting stuff.
Test number four I want to talk about today is the final one. It is VO2 calorie expenditure testing. And Chris, you have something similar that you call FatMax testing. What is this?
Yeah, and there's a lot of different terms for it. Sometimes you'll hear people call it running economy or cycling economy or running efficiency, cycling efficiency.
I have seen that, yep.
Or metabolic efficiency point testing. And that's generally looking at your fat and carb metabolism. So you're doing a VO2 test just like you would for your heart rate zones and figuring out your VO2 max score. But instead of going to your actual VO2 max, you stay at lower intensities and you very gradually pick up the effort over a longer period of time to figure out your fueling plan for an event. So generally the main goal is to figure out, okay, how many calories does my body burn at my, you know, goal race pace or goal power for cycling, you know, or for marathons, your running pace. And we look at exactly how much your body is burning from fat, exactly how much you're burning from carbs. Again, we can dial in the heart rate zones from that, but then we also use that to figure out, okay, how many calories per hour do you need to be fueling in to optimize your performance? And so especially the longer in duration you go, ultra marathons, full Ironman distance events, this actually becomes much more important. Sometimes the simplest way I like to explain this test is I call it the level two test. So after you've done your baseline VO2 and you want to now get more precision with how many calories you're burning at all the kind of more intermediate intensities, it's a secondary test to do. For a triathlete, oftentimes we do the VO2 max test running, and then we do the economy test as a cycling test to dial in your fueling plan on the bike. And that way you kind of have the best of both worlds. You see if your cycling metabolism is a little different and you dial in your fueling plan on the bike, great for half and full Ironmans. And then the VO2 max test gives you your heart rate zones that you're going to use to execute on the run so that you can set a PR and hit those target goals for your run. So they do kind of go hand in hand. It's just another version of the same type of test, just done slightly differently.
Okay.
To give you more detailed precision, essentially.
So with that detailed precision, what do the results look like here that is generated for the athlete? Is it really breaking down? Okay, at each of these intensities, at each of these heart rate zones, this is what your body is fueling off of. Like what are we seeing in the results here?
Yeah, exactly how many calories your body is burning. So, I mean, a great example, like if to throw one of my athletes in the fire as an example, like,
go for it. Do it.
So Jackie Godbee, one of my, top athletes over the years, she won the age group worlds and top esports cyclist,
yay,
swifter.
Jackie.
Yep. Jackie.
Yeah.
We have a lot of local fans here in Chicago of hers. You know, I've tested her a few times on VO2 testing. You know, and we would look at not just her VO2 max and her heart rate zones and all that, but we want to know, okay, how many calories is she burning at the intensities she's pushing? And where can she be a little more efficient? So when she was doing half Ironmans, we could figure out, okay, what race pace does she need to focus on? And then how many gels per hour should she take? And if you ever watch her on the live broadcast when she's doing the esports world championships and whatnot, you'll see usually her husband in the background taking the gel packets out and giving them to her, and you'll see he actually like rolls every ounce out of every gel packet because they want to get that, you know, super precise.
Very measured.
Yeah, the super precise, yeah. Dose. They know, like, okay, she needs exactly, you know, one gel packet every 20 or 25 or 30 minutes, and they want to make sure they're getting exactly what they know that her body needs, and, you know, it's just that extra 1 or 2%. And you know, the stakes get higher the longer the distance. You know, Ironman races, people bonk. A lot of people bonk when you hit that run. And knowing, okay, the difference between 10 or 20 calories early on in the bike can be huge when you get to, you know,
absolutely,
the end of the run.
Yeah.
You know, one example, using myself again, is my first Ironman Wisconsin. I was with another athlete who were always neck and neck in races, and on the bike I passed him, and then mile three of the run, he passes me, but I knew I was a better runner than him. And I'm like, what's going on? He's passing me. He's going faster than me. And this shouldn't be happening. And I did not see him until mile 20 of the marathon. So with only six miles left. But at that point, he had bonked hard. You know, either he paced too hard or didn't fuel properly. And I tried to stick to my plan as best I could. And I was still running at that point. I ended up finishing an hour ahead of him, only passing him at mile 20 of the marathon. So in 6 miles, the very end of the race, because I was doing 10-minute miles and he was walking 20-minute miles, I finished an hour ahead of him. So that late in the race, you know, those small
different
amounts, yep, can make a big, big difference. And sometimes people don't realize that. And that's why we get a lot of people interested in that type of testing, is just to get that little more precision with everything that you're doing. If you're investing so much time and energy into the sport, you know, doing one test to make yourself a smarter athlete who can execute better makes a pretty big difference. It's usually a better investment of your money than, you know, buying a $10,000 new frame or race wheels or whatnot. Like, invest in your health, invest in your education, because that's something you'll use every day in training and racing.
So those are the main four categories for metabolic testing. Very well broken down by Chris and Jeff, our Bill Nye the Science Guy. And this is all very cool stuff. And you both really outlined for us through that conversation what these tests are, you know, which tests we should probably start with, which tests are more in depth if you want to go that extra mile. Very, very helpful for our athletes listening today. And this is all very cool. It's very deep. It's very sciencey. And what I'm wondering is any of this overkill for the average triathlete? Is performance testing more for kind of the pointy end of the performance spectrum? Or, Chris, Jeff, is this helpful for triathletes of all abilities if it fits in their budget? Chris, what do you think?
Yeah, you know, it's generally for everybody. You know, while the upper 1% can use it to get that 1% or 2% more in their performance and dialing things in, it's really a good starting point. You know, if you've never had a test done, it can be a very eye-opening and educational experience. And some of the, you know, biggest impacts I've seen from the tests that we've done over the years are actually with the people who just don't know, you know, why am I bonking in a race? Why am I struggling with this? Or, you know, my coach tells me to do all this zone two training and I don't understand why. I just want to run faster all the time. And when they start seeing their numbers and seeing their metabolism and understand how, hey, that, you know, going 5 to 10 beats a minute easier will actually help me start losing 1 to 2 pounds of body fat more per month because that's what the numbers are showing. Mm. And, you know, for me, that was an eye opener to actually when I did my first test is, you know, I thought I had everything dialed in. And I realized like, yeah, if I actually went 5 to 10 beats a minute slower on my long runs and long bikes, I would have actually oxidized an extra 5 pounds of body fat. And every pound of body fat you lose, you generally run anywhere from 2 to 8 seconds a mile faster. So I would have been, you know, 5 times 5, let's say 25 seconds per mile faster on race day by training easier, not harder. So if you want that performance, it definitely matters. But then if you're struggling with like weight loss, especially, or pacing events, trying to build endurance, getting more precision with your numbers can have a much bigger impact for the people who are in the back of the pack, who are out there all day and are actually doing more work and dealing with more stress. And it's a lot harder to get those things dialed in than it is on the front end of the pack. And I remember I've had actually, I think now two or actually three people who after doing a metabolic test and doing a consultation with me, were actually like in tears, like tears of joy, because all of a sudden things started to click. So it really is for everybody, but it comes down to, you know, figuring out what test might make sense for you and definitely go to the right centers to get tested.
I definitely second. They're for everybody. You're not too old or too out of shape or whatever to do it. I mean, and just like we alluded to earlier, you could be in you know, in your 70s and beating or having better VO2 scores, let's just say, than you were in your 40s and stuff like that. Something that we used to measure is TTE, time to exhaustion. So typically when you do these tests, let's just say the treadmill is at a constant speed, but every 2 minutes or whatever protocol you're using, the ramp may just be going up, up and up until you fail, fatigue, collapse, fail. If you're doing a max test and, you may tie your VO2 from a year ago, let's just say, or earlier in the season, but you made it 2 minutes longer into the protocol. And so you're stronger or more endurance. You're able to hold, that's a sign of strength. You're able to hold that resistance for long enough. And you held it longer and didn't utilize or, you know, as much oxygen doing so. Right. And so there's just so many cool variables that you can, you know, beat yesterday or beat your younger self, so to speak. Some of these cool factors, but time to exhaustion or how far you get into the protocol when you hit those max numbers or sub max, is another really cool, exciting variable, something to shoot for, and that keeps you motivated.
Yeah. You know, great input, Jeff and Chris, from both of you. And I hope people are really encouraged to jump in and Chris, is something you said earlier. I mean, people can absolutely start off with the more, I don't call it entry level, but the less invasive VO2 max or sub max testing, the heart rate zone testing, they don't have to start off just by getting their finger pricked every couple seconds on a ramp test or anything wild. But then if they want it, that kind of next level in-depth data, they can circle back for that test later on. And so that it's definitely something you can slow play over time as your budget allows. But yeah, anybody can get started with this and kind of learn a little bit more about what your body's doing while it's exercising or while at rest. So if someone, Chris, is interested in performance testing, they've heard you guys talk about it today and they feel like that's a good investment for them, both in time, money, et cetera, If we live in Chicago, it's easy. We go to Coach Chris and we call it a day. But for athletes in other locations, how can we best find a qualified testing center? I mean, where I live in Dallas-Fort Worth, there's a lot of people that offer this. So how do you sort through a coach who maybe kind of knows what he's doing and probably the best possible person in your area?
Well, you can always just hop on a flight and come to Chicago, right? No, I'm kidding.
Very true. Yeah.
No, I've actually had people all the way from Alaska and other places fly in to do testing.
Yeah,
so
it's not too
uncommon. Some people have found actually testing centers in different parts of the world that are less expensive, and you can find different experts. So sometimes you can do it around trips and vacations. But yeah, I always say find the experts first and foremost. Look at either, you know, different directories. So USA Triathlon, start at clubs and coaches. Local clubs and coaches are great resources to find through word of mouth where are the places to go really to get tested. There are directories. So I know one, Fitnessity, is kind of like a general one. They just list a whole bunch of different places to do RMR testing, VO2 testing, body composition. DEXA is one that also has a good listing around the country. Or the direct manufacturers. So like I work with Core Medical, K-O-R-R. So their website, you can go on, you can kind of find a list of all the testing centers in the country. And you can find out like which ones offer VO2, which ones offer RMR.
I'll throw in American College of Sports Medicine. That's what I use. A lot of their ranges, a lot of their norms, a lot of their VO2, just all these numbers. They spell it out in a very simplistic way. Easy to understand, and it's just good data, good science. So American College of Sports Medicine is where I get a lot of my guidelines from.
But I would also say, even before finding a place to go get tested, two little tips that I would make sure everyone do first is, one, make sure you have good data going in. So oftentimes these days we have a lot of athletes that use the optical heart rate monitors on the wrist. I would say make the investment maybe first in a chest strap heart rate monitor, just to get good heart rate data, because you'll find you'll end up getting better data for your own training, but then the info you get from your testing will be more accurate when you apply it as well. So I always say do that. And a good learning experience too, if anyone does have like a Garmin watch or a fitness device out there, you can even do it now while you're listening to the podcast. I always have people change the data on their watch to show not just heart rate and beats per minute, but change it to rate of perceived exertion. So on Garmin, I have people change their data field to show percentage of max heart rate. So all of a sudden your heart rate numbers get correlated to your actual rate of perceived exertion. Because once you start doing that, when you do go get tested and you get your heart rate zones updated, things will begin to click and you'll start to see like, hey, your perceived exertion level as a percentage, like 80% effort, 90% effort, will correlate with the data that you see. And that when that connection starts to happen, that's when the magic really begins. So I would always say, before you go get tested and find a center, get good data, start focusing on learning about your heart rate, and then find that expert location to get dialed in. And Don't skip your TriDot assessments. Do those assessments. Do them in different environments, indoors, outdoors. You'll find sometimes just using the TriDot platform is actually the best way to get started. And then the lab testing can be that next level. But always start with the simplest approach. You can always grow into doing more testing down the road.
Great set, everyone. Let's cool down.
Well, hello there, everyone. I'm Vanessa, your average triathlete with elite level enthusiasm. And I'm really looking forward to bringing you today's Coach Cooldown tip. Once upon a time, I had the pleasure of sharing a bus ride with Jen Reinhardt, and I wished I had a notebook to write down all the pearls of wisdom that she shared. I feel grateful that this conversation today is being recorded so that we can all revisit it many times over, which I know I will want to do on a regular basis. Jen is a full-time triathlon coach and coaches master's swimming at a local fitness center. She started swimming at the age of 4 and swam for Purdue University for several years in college. And then triathlon came into her life in about 1984, and since then she has completed a whopping 29 Ironmans and recently locked in her ticket to race in Kona for the 8th time. Jen is certified through USA Cycling, US Masters Swimming. She is a slow twitch swim and Training Peaks coach. Jen is also a USAT Level 2 endurance coach. She is certified through Ironman U and is a TriDot founding Masters coach. Jen has coached all levels of athletes from beginners to elite age groupers and loves working with people who are new to the sport all the way through to those racing Ironman distances. Welcome to the cool down, Jen.
Thanks, Vanessa. I'm so excited when you asked me to be here today. I can't wait to see what you have to ask me.
All right. Well, I do have a question for you to start us off. What is harder, growing up with four older brothers or having completed 29 Ironmans?
Definitely the Ironmans. I was the luckiest little princess in the world. My four older brothers took such good care of me. They did make me into a tomboy, but they were always looking out for me. And the Ironmans are far worse.
I can imagine. But I do also think that there must have been a massive element of growing up with four brothers into making you a super competitive person, because you probably just always wanted to keep up with them and do everything that they were doing. And
exactly. Yeah. It didn't matter if it was swimming or school, you know, getting straight A's like they did so I could get my Cincinnati Reds tickets like they did, playing baseball or football in the backyard with their friends and a few of mine. But I was always chasing after them, and they were very kind to allow me to do that.
Well, kind is a very nice word for you to use. That just goes to show your amazing character.
And they're great now. They love when they see on Facebook that I'm going to do another Ironman. It's like they're always cheering for me. It'd be really fun to have them come sometime.
Oh, I hope that becomes a reality for you. That would be totally amazing. I'm not sure if you have heard, but I was actually convinced by three pretty inspiring TriDot athletes to do my first Ironman later this year in California. So I am really looking forward to what you have to share with us today. So what nugget of wisdom do you have for us?
I think especially for first-time Ironmans, this one really is important, and that's to focus on what you can control. And I have so many great reasons this is true from just my most recent Ironman Texas experience. The weather in Texas changes from 5 minutes ago to 5 minutes from now, and our weather forecast was all over the place leading up to the couple of weeks before the race. And I kept telling a couple of my local athletes who were racing with me, it's like, you guys got to stop looking at it daily. Yes, we need to prepare. You know, if it's cold, we need certain things to wear. If it's not wetsuit legal, we need to, you know, we'll have practice in our skins. We'll have practice in our wetsuits. We'll be prepared, but it's taking too much of your attention away from just some of the little things. And you're getting too worried about something that you can't change the outcome of. So we kept going back and forth with that. And then as it got closer to race day, you know, I get a little nervous too, just like they do. And we start looking, and the wind's one way and then the wind's the next way. And okay, guys, we can't control the wind. What can we control? We can make sure that our bike is really ready to go. We can make sure that we have our nutrition plan down. You know, it's memorized. We know how we're going to, you know, do it on the bike, what we're going to grab, what we're going to eat. You know, let's work on the things. Let's work through the race mentally, you know, what we're going to do, what we can control. Let's put a few of those things that we can't control to the side. And then they finally published a participant list. And yes, I did want to get that Kona slot that you mentioned. And it's like, oh gosh, you know, this lady, she was in Kona last year. Look at her time. This lady was there last year. And I'm going, what am I doing? I can't control how they're going to race. I've got to look at and think about, I've really prepared well. How can I have a good race? And just go out and do the best that I can that day. Stay in the moment, stay present, as I think Coach Kurt always says. And just, you know, nail the things that I can do. And so that's what I did. I was really lucky that I got that slot, but I kept pushing till the end to, you know, finish in the best that I could on that day, given the different things that happened. And everybody always has a story about what happens in an Ironman. You're going to have a story come October. But yeah, just be, you know, mindful of trying to narrow in on what you can control and try to let some of that outside chatter about all these different things that you don't have any control over, let it kind of be silenced.
Something that you said that I love very much is that you're talking about all of these things pre-race, all of the mindset things that you want to have before the race in terms of what you can control regarding that race. And what I find really interesting is as soon as you start that race, it's like everything you thought prior to that, you forget about anyways. But then this tip also comes into play, and you have to constantly think about the things that you can control during the race as well. You know, like you have to think about, I don't know, what do you think about that? Like, tell me what about what you can control during the race itself.
During the race, I want to get in the line for the time trial start swim where I want to be. So I feel like I'm not having to swim through people, but I'm also not getting people that are swimming over top of me, and reminding myself to sight, stay on course, don't swim extra. One thing that I always do and I recommend to my athletes is pacing in open water is so difficult. So when you get it, you find a groove, make sure that it's the right groove. If I take 20 strokes stronger, do I still feel okay? Or is it too fast? Or, you know, or if I've found feet and it feels really good, and you start to move a little bit off those feet and you realize those feet were really good, just stay right there. I had that going up the channel at Ironman Texas. Once you hit the bike, it's all about nutrition and pacing. You know, don't worry about, especially a strong swimmer, I get passed by so many men quickly out of the swim into the bike portion. So I've got to not worry about anybody passing me. I'm looking at my heart rate. I'm looking at my power. I'm thinking about, okay, it's 10 minutes, 15 minutes. I need 20 minutes. I need to be, what am I going to drink? What am I going to eat? And just staying mindful of my plan and not about anybody else's plan. That moves on, you know, I'm kind of skip T1 and T2, but you want to be quick and efficient in transition, but you don't want to forget something. Don't have too many options. Have what you need. Because if there's a whole lot of options, it's going to take longer, and then it can throw off your plan. I do all that mental preparation beforehand so that I can control that better on race day. And yes, race morning before the gun goes off, I've forgotten all about that. But then as each phase of the race comes back in, it's like, I know what I need to do. I thought about that and I have a plan, and you just keep going through it.
Thanks for joining us. Make sure to subscribe and share the TriDot podcast with your triathlon crew. For more great Tri content and community, connect with us on Facebook, YouTube, and Instagram. Ready to optimize your training? Head to TriDot.com and start your free trial today. TriDot, the obvious and automatic choice for triathlon training.